This is The Waves.
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 Welcome to The Waves, Slate's podcast about gender, feminism, and untangling the snake linguine. Every episode, you get a new pair of women to talk about the thing we can't get off our minds. And today, you've got me, Lily Loofborough, a staff writer for Slate.
And me, Emily Peck. I'm a longtime business journalist. I co-host Slate Money and, this is key, Slate Money's weekly succession recap podcast. And also the producers of The Waves, they usually call me when it's time to talk about rich white ladies. So here I am.
All right. So this week we're talking about the men versus the women of Succession. The much-loved HBO drama about a Rupert Murdoch-style patriarch whose children are vying for control of the family company, even though he's not at all ready to let go. Succession is kind of a bro-y show, created by Jesse Armstrong, whose former work includes Peep Show, the best and funniest show about modern masculinity in TV history, in my opinion. Succession takes on masculine ego and narcissism with brio. The dialogue's terrific, the satire is sharp, and the approach to abuses of power is unapologetic. So whenever one of the Roy boys fails to be anything short of a dick in their treatment of an adversary, or confesses to a sentiment like love, their father, Logan Roy, calls them gay, or women, or both. And so this puts the one female sibling, Siobhan, nicknamed Shiv, in a weird position. She has to be able to roll with the boys, but she's not quite expected to operate like they do. And that's not an advantage. Shiv might be Logan's favorite, Pinky he calls her, but her femaleness is always salient and strategic. She's never just being judged on her merits, so she's constantly on guard against becoming merely a token woman in a company culture that needs a makeover because of the rapes and murders that took place under its male leadership.
Minor things. So,
there's no way to win in this world, but this week we're talking about how the men are doing versus the women. And I'll be honest, I have been souring on Shiv for a while. This show is so wary of making her stereotypically feminine in any legible way that it's accidentally made her kind of a cipher. But Emily, why did you want to talk about this?
Well, this is a topic I can't stop thinking about in the parlance of The Waves because I have to watch the show to do the Slate recap podcast, first of all, because I love the show. So, and it's just a pleasure to kind of talk about it and luxuriate in the universe of Succession, which is pretty removed from my reality or anyone's reality, I think, lately, except for maybe a few billionaires here and there. In 2019, I wrote about the show because I admired the way Succession treats women, especially compared with other HBO shows where women, I mean, one of the reasons HBO was founded as a television network was so they could show women's breasts, basically. And they've really held true to that over the years, I think, in their prestige drama. But Succession isn't like that. One of the show's writers, Lucy Prebble, has said, like, we're just not interested in having people take their clothes off. I know that's a pretty low bar, but I also think the show handles well kind of double bind that women in corporate America and these big companies are in. You know, they need to be tough, but they also need to be feminine. They have to struggle with men like Logan Roy, who absolutely does not respect women at all in the workplace. And I think it handles that well without being pedantic about it. So yeah, I'm excited to talk about this. Let's get into it.
Great. Well, so this being The Waves, we're going to start off talking about the women. So Jerry is now CEO of Waystar Royco, and Shiv is quote-unquote president of domestic affairs. Marcia is making Logan pay for his dalliance with Rhea. Does this mean the women of Succession have finally won? We'll discuss as soon as we're back. Thank you so much for listening. If you're loving the show and want to hear more, subscribe to our feed. New episodes come out every Thursday morning. While you're there, check out our other episodes too, like last week's where Allegra Frank and Shayna Roth talked about horror movies.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
It'd be easy to argue that the women of Succession are in the ascent. Shiv has finally been rewarded for all her vacillating back and forth with a position that sounds important. She's president now of domestic affairs, and Jerry is theoretically in charge. But it doesn't seem like they're actually much better off. Emily, can you catch us up on what's going on with the power struggles among the Roys?
Yes, I think so. This season, there's kind of a civil war among the Roys. There's Patriarch Logan on the one side and his son, the second oldest, but sort of most favored, I'd say, son, Kendall, who at the end of season two basically started the war by calling his father, TLDR, a terrible person at a press conference and saying his father covered up crimes and so on. So this season, the two of them are on like opposing sides. Kendall has tried to get his siblings. There's Siobhan, there is Roman, and Connor. He's tried to get them lined up on his side. They have rejected him. And basically, Siobhan is using the crisis as kind of this wedge to get into the company. Like you said, Lily, she's now the president of domestic affairs. This is very typical, I think, for women in the corporate worlds. There's a name for this. It's called the glass cliff. And the other thing to know is that Jerry and Siobhan both are on this glass cliff now because this is a company in crisis. And as a result, they've both ascended. But that's not necessarily a good thing.
In Shiv's situation, I want to talk about Shiv in particular, and her situation at present, I think, is interesting because it feels like she beat her brothers. Her dad gave her a title, but this title is actually made up, and so there is a question as to how real it is, because as we know, Logan, the patriarch, has a habit of kind of conferring power but not really meaning it. He's done that already with Jerry, who he's called a hazmat suit for himself and his family in her capacity as CEO now, where she can take the hits that they should probably be receiving. But I am very curious to see how much Shiv's title is equally meaningless. But in any event, Shiv is very interesting, and I've said that I've soured her on a bit, by which I mean that I've stopped finding her character interesting or surprising. And I'm sad about that. I think Succession is brilliant at writing men. And I totally agree with you, Emily, that it's been great at not showing tits and ass on the women. And that there are some really interesting women. And that I think for a long time I thought Shiv was among them. But it has felt to me more and more like there are hints of deep intelligence and vision and strategic cunning that she has that keep not manifesting in practice. The guys are kind of different. I think Shiv has been psychologically portrayed as very put together, but the men are vulnerable. So whether they're weaselly or narcissistic or self-aggrandizing or simply scary, they have layers. And more importantly, the way those layers interact is psychologically pretty well spelled out. Like, we've spent a lot of time alone with Kendall. We know how he works and how he's suffered. He and Roman they're vulnerable, right? In ways that make them legible and human. And it also makes them seem weak to their dad. But I can't say the same for Shiv. Snook does like an amazing job playing her. You know, her smirks and her eye rolls and her sarcasm do so much to really enrich a character who otherwise I think just isn't actually as defined or well-written as her brothers. And it's possible, I think, that since Shiv is a woman and they're trying to protect her from feminine stereotypes, Shiv's vulnerabilities aren't written in ways that make her psychologically legible. Like, I think Kendall and Roman are wounded. They're wounded by abuse, and they're aching for their dad's approval. So, you know, they're trying in ways that are kind of coded, masculine, and desperate. They're eccentric and weird, and they throw out these bizarre visions and strategies for the company that can sometimes be compelling, even when they're really bizarre. But Shiv is very power suit in her present iteration to me. Like, I was more interested in her when she was kind of a bohemian political consultant who was rebelling against her dad. But now she seems to me like hopelessly focus grouped. There just doesn't seem to be anything driving her except for simple lust for power. And she's not even playing that game that well. Like, she knows that her dad hates constraints and rejects limits. But it feels to me that in practice, that all she does is point out what the limits and constraints are and how to operate within them in a very politically savvy way, but not in a visionary CEO type way. Like, her memo for the company seems to have struck everyone as like you know, kind of hilariously generic, and every one of her instincts seems conformist to me. And so in this episode, even when her speech got interrupted, thank God, it seemed to me like it was just pure corporate boilerplate. So I was almost grateful to Kendall, almost grateful to Kendall for sabotaging her. But I want to hear what you think about that and about her revenge on Kendall.
Okay, well, there's a lot to unpack with what you just said, Lily. And again, it's very convincing what you're saying, because there is a difference between the way the siblings are portrayed, and it does seem to break along gendered lines. And Shiv does seem to be, I guess you could say she is portrayed as less vulnerable, but I think throughout this series, there have been these like moments where she has cracked that have been interesting. I think in this week's episode, spitting in Kendall's notebook after he sabotages her speech is a moment of, I mean, it's a lashing out moment, and it's very Roy and very aggressive and like wounded animal hurting and lashing out kind of moment, but it's still a moment of vulnerability. And we've seen that before with her, with her husband. You know, she couldn't decide whether or not to fire Tom at the end of season two when they needed a head on a plate, or whatever the term was, you know, a sacrifice, a blood sacrifice. She asked her father, please, you know, please don't, not Tom, just don't do this. And that was a moment of vulnerability for her.
So, what do you think? It's the sort of tough choice people need to be able to make. People who would be very senior people.
I can't choose that.
No. No.
Just not,
the other thing I would say about her is that she comes across as more competent than her brothers in terms of, and you see this as this season three, I've had the privilege of like watching a little bit ahead, and she is, I think, more competent at getting things done than Kendall and Roman, who are just kind of like, I think, kind of bumbling a lot of the times, and just, they don't understand how they seem to the rest of the world. That's it. I don't think Kendall, you know, who said fuck the patriarchy in this week's episode, I don't think he understands how he comes off. Shiv understands. Like, that is her superpower. She gets a lot of it, not all the time. There's blind spots. These are billionaires. They don't really understand what real people think, but like, she understands self-presentation and she understands appearances. I mean, she was like a comms person in politics, so she understands messaging and all of that. So I don't think she's just a cipher, and I don't think her power hunger is any different from Kendall's or Roman's. Like, they're all hungry for power pretty much in the same kind of way. And it's an empty hunger. It's really just like a stand-in for wanting their dad to love them, I think.
I mean, I think what I would, maybe what I should try to refine my point, which is not that she is differently power hungry, but that there are human cores, I think, to Kendall certainly, and to a lesser extent to Roman, that where I really get their psychology, right? Like, I really understand Roman's, whatever his weird sort of sexual hangups are, that create this weird psychodrama with Jerry. It's really interesting and compelling, and I have a bead on it somehow. And with Kendall, his struggles with addiction, and you know, his obvious push and pull with his dad, I have a handle, I guess, on what makes them tick. And I feel like what happens with Shiv is that she does get, as you say, you're right, there are moments of vulnerability. And I want to talk a little bit about the one where she does seem to choose Tom over her chance at being CEO when she asks Logan to protect Tom. I thought that was a fascinating moment. And I think what frustrates me is that there doesn't seem to be a follow through to it. So like with Kendall, his psychological journey is very precisely calibrated, and step by step you can kind of see to where he's getting. And I think Shiv is kind of constitutionally opaque in the writing. Getting to that moment where she chooses Tom at the end of season two, it seemed to me fascinating for her character. I was like, yes, this is the arc I've been waiting for. Like, this seems to me like an act of real self-sacrifice. And it's a decisive moment of making a hard choice proactively, right? Rather than just reacting to what others were doing. I thought she was knowingly destroying her chances of becoming CEO by begging him to spare Tom. It's true that Logan might honor that, but he would also see her as weak and unfit to lead by his own sort of fucked up criteria. But so it seemed to me like she was choosing love over ambition in a marriage that she had not previously prioritized. So that seemed huge to me. Like, I thought it was like the biggest development in her arc. But it feels to me like season three, which begins literally minutes after this happened, kind of forgot that it even happened. So I guess this is what I mean about the writing for her feeling a little bit wobbly and insufficient. I want to see Shiv's journey desperately, but it keeps on feeling kind of governed by external signifiers of power plays rather than like by inner motions that I feel like the guys get more. However, I'm really curious to see her working with Jerry, the woman who's quote unquote actually in charge. Like, will they get along? Will they clash? I don't know. What do you think?
This season, it feels like when Jerry was coming up, because we know she's been at Waystar Royco for 35 years, and this is a company that's all men. There's a great scene in an early season where everyone's watching like a sexual harassment training video or something, and it's just all men watching it. And the video says, like, we believe in diversity, blah, blah, blah. And it's like all just men, white men in suits coming out. So like Jerry came up in that atmosphere where she's the only woman, or at least that's what it seems like. It's never explicitly spelled out, but I feel we can assume this. And now Shiv is kind of, by coming in, as they like to call it, are you going to come in? Are you going to work for the company? You know, she is challenging Jerry, possibly, who's used to being kind of a token, which I think is kind of setting them up to be a bit at odds with each other. And I think we'll see that going forward in the show. I think they will definitely clash, because there's the competing to be the one woman thing on top of the other like theme of succession, which is the annoying kids trying to pretend they know how to do business stuff versus like the old hands like Jerry, like Frank, like Carl, who actually have done work in the company for a long time and know what they're doing, and they're not just there because of nepotism. I guess the other thing, if we're going to talk about the women of succession besides Shiv, the other thing that I've been a little bit let down by in season three so far is that we haven't had those like very compelling side characters that we had a last time. Like, we had Cherry Jones and Holly Hunter playing these like very interesting and complicated older women, which I really, really loved. And this season, well, I mean, we have to talk about Naomi Pierce, played by Annabelle Dexter Jones, she's Kendall's girlfriend. She's blonde. Well, I don't know what else to say about this character. It's just, there's nothing much going on there, right?
I know. And you know, it's weird because Naomi seemed interesting last season to
right.
me. Like, she had a lot of pain, and it seemed like their connection was robust and like substantive in a way that I was really sold on. I was like, yes, these two children of ultra rich tyrants would, of course, right, have a lot to bond with and through. Like, I was interested in that relationship. And this season, I don't know, she feels kind of like frivolous and petty and enabling.
Yeah, I feel like, what's the psychological term? It's like trauma bonding or something, like his trauma and her trauma. It's like a plug in a, you know, they plug in well together, their wounds and such. And I thought that was going to be really interesting, just like you said. And instead, it's just like she's just kind of in the background of these scenes where Kendall is just making a fool out of himself, and she doesn't seem to care. It's weird. Where are the writers
on
her?
It's very weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. The last woman I really want to talk about is, like, I was so happy to see Marcia back. I love Marcia. Every line of hers just crackles, and it's so pleasurable to see Logan have to actually pay, I guess literally, for something he's done. But her ruthlessness is something I really enjoy, and it's coming from a totally different place and a totally different angle than everyone else on the show. Like, I don't hope that anybody wins, but if Marcia ends up using the intel that she has on how Logan covered up the drowned waiter to bring them all down, I will cheer.
Yeah, hear, hear. More Marsha, and whatever she can do to take Logan down a peg is much appreciated.
We're going to take a break here, but if you're enjoying The Waves, we would love it if you would like and subscribe to The Waves wherever you get your podcasts.
And if you want to hear more from Lily and myself on another topic, check out our Waves Plus segment, Is This Feminist?, where today we debate whether Elaine Benes from Seinfeld, played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, is feminist.
And The Waves needs your help. We're closing out 2021 with two very special Waves reunion episodes. We're bringing back original hosting panels June Thomas, Noreen Malone, and Hannah Rosen ahead of Christmas, and Marsha Chatelain, Nicole Perkins, and Christina Cotterucci for New Year's. And we'd love to hear from you. Send them your questions and thoughts for discussion at thewaves@slate.com.
Can I just say I'm so excited for June, Noreen, and Hannah to come back, because I have been listening to this podcast since, like, I think 2009 or something. I don't know. I'm so excited. I feel like I'll be hearing from old friends, even though I don't know them.
Okay, so what about the men? Tom has offered to go to jail for Logan. Kendall has been denounced in public by his sister and given up on his resolution to be quote-unquote part of the conversation, and he's hiding in an electrical closet. Logan's being raided by the FBI. Is Roman in the best position right now?
I don't think there is a single man in a good position in this show, except for, I guess, Logan, though, as you said, the FBI just raided his office. Except for Logan, who retains all power for himself and has done throughout this show. He has elided any opportunity to have a successor. I'd love for you to talk more about the show's conception of masculinity. I sort of wonder about Logan, masculinity, and the actual, what I think is the driving force of all the drama in this show, which bottom line is just about a father who has deep emotional wounds, is failing to actually actively love his children and be there emotionally for them, and sort of manipulating their need for his love. And I feel like that is kind of all tied up in notions of what it means to be a man and masculinity. And it's just something I think about kind of a lot when I'm looking at the news, especially after all those years living in Trump's America, of how expectations for masculinity damage men, and those men become really powerful and, like, damage all of us.
Yeah. I mean, I thought one of the saddest moments in this week's episode was when it becomes clear that Roman has literally no pleasant memories with his father and has to borrow one from an excursion that he took with his brother Connor. Like, that's just devastating.
And then, you know, I think that you know that there's this idea that everyone thought it'd be really kind of fun if after everything we might open up the door and some family stuff for a little bit. No, I know. And we won't dwell on it, so we'll just keep it loose and be fun to freewheel with it. Hmm?
Tell me precisely every single word they're going to ask me.
Well, I couldn't disclose specific questions because of our policies at ATN Business, and that would be ethically, you know. But it might be something like, Logan seems like a business-oriented guy. What's something special that you and your dad enjoy doing together?
No. Next question.
Okay, sure. What was a time that your dad came to your aid when you really needed him?
No, I'm not doing that one.
Right. What is your most cherished father-son memory?
So far, these are bad.
Well, how about you lead? Is there some sort of childhood story that you'd like to tell?
I got a memory in the old bankiola. It's a fly fishing in Montana, if
sure
that interests you.
Thank you, Mr. Roy.
Logan's vision of power is so kind of pathologically rooted in domination with the boar on the floor
yes.
crap that everyone around him has to be submissive and cringing, including like Carl and Frank, his closest advisors. So like, of course, right, it unfits his sons for power based on his own idea of how power works. Like, I mean, I feel like 1,000 essays were written about Logan's expression at the end of season 2 when Kendall betrayed him. There was like that hint of a smile that Brian Cox had on his face. It seemed to imply that he was pleased, right, to see his son finally as the killer he wanted, even if it came at his own expense. But I wondered then, and I wonder now, whether Logan is even enough of a parent, like whether he's constitutionally capable of caring more about his son's personal development into the right kind of monster than he is about his own control of the company.
Yeah. We had an interesting conversation about this, I think, on next week's episode of Slate Money Succession. We had this guy, Michael Mechanic, on. He's like a senior editor at Mother Jones, and he wrote a whole book about rich people. We were asking him, like, are the Roys a typical rich family? And one point he made was, rich people like Logan Roy are too busy to be loving parents. He told a story about a woman raised a millionaire, and he said that she had only had dinner with her father as a child five times, that she could remember five times. Like,
whoa.
And then you kind of look at the way Kendall is not interacting with his children so far in season three and barely in the show. Billionaires who are pursuing power don't have time to be anything but sociopathic parents. And that can cause a lot of problems that we're seeing in the show.
That's fascinating. I mean, I think like the opening credits actually do such a nice job of like basically creating kind of visual poem around that alienation and like the formality of the dad's occasional visual presence with those kids. I suppose, right, that also explains the attention seeking.
Right? Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, the extent to which the power plays aren't just power plays, but are just like desperate attempts to get attention from the dad in any way possible. That's really interesting.
There's that viral, have you seen the viral video where the guy, he sings over the Succession theme song, and it's like something about a kiss from daddy?
And then whoever's best is going to win that kiss from daddy. All the rich white folk are going to argue, and then whoever's best is going to win that kiss from daddy.
It's actually quite accurate. They're all just trying to get a kiss from daddy.
And I mean, you know, and I will say that that's what I think sets Succession apart from like maybe some comparable shows. A lot of its masculinity is actually quite soft, right? I mean, it's about masculine neediness and insecurity and sadness. And returning to your point about Succession not having tits and ass, right? And like not writing women that way. There is a whole universe of shows about corporate America that are kind of in the vein of the American Psycho bro, right? And I would expect a show like this to be heavily populated by that kind of character. And Stewie, frankly, is the only one who even comes close, besides Logan, that is to say, like to that version of predatory sociopathy. And I find that really interesting. Like I am interested in the range of masculinities that are on display in Succession. And I think it's a very rich brew, not just Carl, not just Frank, but I'm even really fascinated by, you know, Fisher Stevens is Hugo, who's a relatively new character, and he seems just a little bit different from Logan's other male satellites. Like, he seems better somehow at managing Logan than Carl or Frank. He's been grooming his way into Logan's good graces over the last few episodes with real speed and success, and it might be, like, just very low-key, one of the more interesting arcs to watch. Like, why is he rising so quickly? You know, why has he gotten so close to the center without pissing Logan off the way that Frank seems to continually do by barely saying anything at all, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, he hasn't yet betrayed Logan as I guess Frank did in a previous season. And he doesn't pretend to be better than Logan. I think one of the tensions with Logan and Frank is that Frank fancies himself a bit of a literary fellow. You know, he quotes Shakespeare here and there. And I don't think Logan, he feels a little, puts him on the defensive. He's not an academic or anything like that. So I think there's that tension there. And Hugo is just more ingratiating and sort of like snake-like. And that kind of gets him in, kind of just slithering in to, I don't know, making his moves. I'm not sure what the deal is. He's more willing to be subservient too, in a way that, and just literally like serve Logan, like, shuttle them around in planes and, you know, hotel rooms in a way that Frank and Carl can't, because they're like executives, I guess, or, you know, like C-level executives. They're not going to like book a room in a hotel or anything like that. But like Hugo can do that kind of stuff. He's not a
that
threat.
That is so interesting. Right. He's not a threat. I hadn't. Yeah. No, you're so right about Frank. I hadn't thought about that. Because it's true that even that you're right, Frank betrays Logan. So one could forgive Logan for, I guess,
you're not being trusted. Suspicious of him. You're mashed potatoes.
You're mashed potatoes. But I mean, you know, the pilot has Logan firing Frank for no reason, just because he wants to get Roman to sign. You know, I mean, the hostility goes back.
Yes, like, absolutely.
And that makes sense, right? You're saying that he's elitist.
I was going to say, we can't let this episode go and this discussion of masculinity pass without digging in on Tom and Greg, right, Lily?
Yeah. Yeah, it's so, I mean, so many of the most quoted lines from Succession, I feel like, come from Tom and Greg scenes, right? They really have become, I don't know, I think they started off as like a funny kind of comic relief Rosencrantz and Guildenstern kind of function in Succession. They were kind of two marginal clowns trying to worm their way into the center, and Tom was trying to exercise what little power he has over somebody, and so Greg ends up being the hapless recipient of both his like training wheel monster efforts at domination and also the recipient of all of his genuine love. So like it's this really strange amalgam of abuse and friendship and mutual exploitation, but in a show that is ostensibly right about the core family, by which I really mean Logan and his three children, not including Connor, because Connor is so rarely a player. It's kind of interesting that I think that Tom and Greg's friendship, which maybe exists because they're not literally part of that family in the same way, is starting to feel like its emotional center to me.
I think that feels right. I think there is a genuine bond between those characters. I think, I mean, you can't make a Tomlet without breaking some Gregs, first of all. But I think for Tom, he saw like both a rival and an ally in Greg, because they were both kind of, like you said, in the same position of like trying to break into the family. You know, Tom's trying to do it by being married to Siobhan, and Greg's doing it because he's cousin Greg and like trying to exploit whatever he can to get a bunch of money for himself or get a job, or it's unclear to me exactly what Greg really wants, because he's not trying to get a kiss from daddy, really, you know, but Tom kind of is. But it seems like they both, I think emotionally, I think it's coming from Tom to Greg a lot more than the opposite direction. I think he's sort of, I don't know, he feels something for him, because there are these moments with Tom where it's like, he does seem like a vulnerable and almost quite normal person. He seemed like a genuine person with genuine sort of like emotional hopes and dreams in a way that the others don't. And he attaches some emotion for whatever reason to Greg. Maybe he sees himself in Greg or something.
I mean, it feels like he displaces a lot of that sort of longing for some kind of traditional love relationship with Siobhan onto Greg. So when Greg tells him he wants to switch to Parks, like, Tom's, remember he starts hurling water bottles?
Like, I just don't really love it, and I want to go explore. Uh-huh. And then I can come back, you know? It could be like a business open relationship.
This is not a good feeling, Greg, that you're making me have, you know? Can you stop crunching?
Sure. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm feeling...
What?
I feel a little bit... You know?
I know. It's just an idea.
Fuck.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, Tom. Hey, Tom. We're good.
We're good? Because it doesn't feel fucking good, Greg!
Let's just, can we...
I will not let you do this to me! I will not let go of what is mine!
The strength of Tom's feeling for Greg. The magnitude of the sense of betrayal he feels when, you know, Greg is trying to sort of go his own way is so disproportionate. Tom appears to be a somewhat normal human who is trying to ape what the Roy family does. So, like, yes, he tried to use people as furniture because he thinks that's a thing that the Roys do. His efforts to mimic the version of coldness and ruthlessness that the Roys, I think, are brought up to are comical. But also, he just really craves genuine connection, and Greg seems to be the only place where he's able to produce it.
Yes. And it just occurred to me while you were talking that when he's throwing those water bottles at Greg, he's really throwing the water bottles at Siobhan. Because Siobhan has just told him she wants an open relationship, you know, on their wedding night, exactly when you should time such a conversation. And he's mad about it, but he acts pretty cool because he's in a weird power dynamic with his wife, right? Where, like, she's not just his wife, she's like his entree into an executive role at this big company and stuff. So he can't like get that angry at her, but he can get that angry at Greg.
Daddy's kiss. On which way Goldberg going to argue? And then whoever's best is going to win that kiss from Daddy. All the rich white folk are going to argue, and the new whoever's best is going to win that kiss from Daddy.
Before we head out, we want to give some recommendations. Lily, what are you loving right now?
Well, I have been into fountain pens for a while. I've been kind of going deeper into fountain pen land, which is, boy, is it a rich subculture, let me tell you.
Wait, Lily. First of all, can you explain to me a rube who just steals pens from people and doesn't buy them even? What exactly is a fountain pen? Is that an old-timey, is there a quill involved? Can you just tell me what it is?
There's not a quill, but there is a nib, and there's some kind of ink containing mechanism, right? So whether it's a converter that you fill up with ink, or an ink cartridge that you plug into the pen so that you can use it. Not quill era, but a little bit after graphic of a pen. It will have that pretty little nib that looks kind of like an arrow. And
does it make a scraping sound on the paper?
Oh, I'm so happy you asked me that, because that's where my recommendation is going. No. A good one should not scratch. A fountain pen should be a smooth writing experience, and a lot more ink comes out at a time. One starts to acquire appreciations for different kinds of nibs, right? Do you want a hard one or a soft one, a firm or whatever? What I've recently discovered is that gold-tipped gold nibs are incredible to write with, because gold is so soft. So it's just a beautiful material to write with. And the blackness of the line when you put it down is just like unsurpassed. Such a pleasure. The problem with that is gold nibs are really expensive.
I would imagine so.
So if you don't want to spend a fortune on them, it turns out that there is a workaround. And the workaround is vintage pens. There is this whole market of like pens from the 1950s onward that were incredible. Like Parkers and Pilots from that era are so much better than the equivalents today. So you can get these beautiful old pens with incredible gold nibs for pretty cheap. And so that is my recommendation. It has changed my life, and I write with this pen all the time, and all of my other ones now feel inferior in comparison to it. How about you?
I wanted to recommend another podcast. It's called, and it's specifically, I'm recommending it for the Succession fans that are listening today. It's called The Just Enough Family. And it is about a very rich family, the Steinbergs, who became super fabulously, incredibly billionaire level, crazy wealthy in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and then basically lost it all One of the daughters is Liz Lang, who founded a line of maternity clothes that are considered like very revolutionary. I mean, it's just, it's so good. It's two brothers. One is like a genius who goes to Wharton and becomes a corporate raider in the 80s. All kinds of hijinks ensue, just exactly kind of what you would expect from, if you've watched Succession, you will inhale this podcast. It's hosted by Ariel Levy, who's a writer for The New Yorker and is friends with Liz Lang, who she was able to interview for this podcast. So it's like a very underproduced podcast. The interviews are like very raw. And there's like at one point, Liz Lang says something like, I never spoke to my father about this. Like we never just talked about it or got it all out. And Ariel Levy says, that's so Goyesha. And it just like, it's such a great moment in interviewing. And I hope that makes you want to listen because it's really good.
Wow, that sounds amazing. And it could not be more fitting for our discussion today.
Yeah, I devoured it.
All right, well, that's our show this week. The Waves is produced by Shayna Roth.
Susan Matthews is our editorial director with June Thomas providing oversight and moral support.
If you like the show, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. And please consider supporting the show by joining Slate Plus. Members get benefits like zero ads on any Slate podcast and bonus content of shows like this one. It's only $1 for the first month. To learn more, go to slate.com/thewavesplus.
We'd also love to hear from you. Email us at thewaves@slate.com.
The Waves will be back next week. Different hosts, different topic, same time and place.